Bass player Rob Wasserman, and we heard a selection from his new album, which is called Solo, and it's on Rounder Records. We heard Rob Wasserman in conversation with WHYY's Bob Carlin, and Bob is the host of Country Boy Rock and Roll, which you can hear here on 91FM every Saturday afternoon from 2 until 5 o'clock. They recorded that interview a couple of weeks ago when Wasserman was in Philadelphia to perform at Ripley's with the David Grisman Band. It's 2 minutes after 4 o'clock, and this is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. You're listening to Fresh Air. With me now is John G. Adams, who in 1953 became counselor of the Army. Adams was a moderate Republican who didn't think highly of McCarthy, but on the other hand, had never actively opposed him or questioned his emphasis on loyalty oaths. Adams' first major assignment with the Army was serving as their liaison with McCarthy. Adams' reluctant cooperation with McCarthy developed into a firm resistance to McCarthy's demands. In 1954, McCarthy threatened to subpoena members of the Army Loyalty Board as revenge against the Army for refusing to grant special favors to McCarthy aide David Shine, who was in the Army. In response, John Adams leaked to the press a collection of documents and journal entries detailing his communications with McCarthy and McCarthy's illegal methods of harassment. This precipitated the Army-McCarthy hearings, which were televised, and turned American popular opinion against McCarthy, leading to the end of his power. John Adams has written a new book chronicling his encounters with McCarthy and the Army-McCarthy hearings. This book is called Without Precedent, and it's just been published by Norton Books. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air, John Adams.
Thank you.
Why did you decide nearly 30 years after the Army-McCarthy hearings to write this book?
Well, McCarthy burst very suddenly onto the international scene in 1950. He'd been in the Senate nearly 4 years then, and his rampage lasted after that until 1954. At the time of the Army-McCarthy hearings, when he went into eclipse. Now, 29 years have elapsed since those hearings, and no person under the age of 48, which is over half of our population, and importantly, the group which is now taking over and running the country, the governors, the teachers, the legislators, and the newsmen, no such person was an adult during the McCarthy era, and few probably have any real appreciation of what it was like then for people in government, teachers, and the paranoia that existed, the fear and the morbid guilt by association atmosphere that existed all over the country, and particularly in the government and in Washington. Now, the writers in this New Age group, contemporary historians, are somewhat revisionist. They're tending to rationalize that McCarthyism wasn't so bad, that he was overrated, and that the threat wasn't bad, but that just isn't so. Those of us who lived through the era, and as government officials particularly, remember it otherwise. And I hope that my book will tell part of the story, because this new generation of leaders shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the danger is always present.
You remind your readers in your book that in 1949, McCarthy was voted the worst U.S. senator in a poll of Senate correspondents. What won him that title?
Well, McCarthy entered the Senate in 1947. And for the first 3 years in the Senate, he did nothing constructive. He took what was clearly a bribe from a housing organization which wanted some housing legislation handled by the committee on which he was a member. He misbehaved in many other ways. He abused one of the senators by the name of Raymond Baldwin so badly that Baldwin resigned from the Senate. And said that when he resigned, he'd done so because McCarthy's attacks on him had been the last straw. Prior to that time, his behavior as a judge in Wisconsin had been so bad that he was censured by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and almost immediately after he was elected to the Senate, moves were made to recall him and to have the State Bar of Wisconsin disbar him, and there were constant attacks on him. And in his home state of Wisconsin between 1947 and 49, those 3 years, every newspaper who attacked him, which were they were the main newspapers, and they had supported him initially, the Madison Capital Times and the Milwaukee Journal. He attacked them as being communists. He had attacked his general election campaign opponent, Howard McMurray, who was a University of Wisconsin professor, as being a communist. He had attacked Willa Follett, the senator he defeated in the primaries and accused him of being a communist. And in the Senate, he didn't do much during his first 3 years except to drink and to carouse and to abuse people and accuse people of all sorts of things. And he was guilty of a great number of improprieties, so that he'd been investigated by the Senate twice in the first 3 years he was there, something that rarely happens. They rarely investigate another senator. And this poll taken of the newsman who covered the Senate, they voted almost unanimously that he was the worst United States senator. That's after he'd been in the Senate for 3 full years.
Do you think he consciously chose the anti-communist campaign as a way to make a name for himself?
No, I don't think he consciously chose it as... Well, he was looking for a way to make him make a name for himself. He hardly chose it because of convictions. He was an opportunist. And he met with some people in January of 1950 and said he needed an issue because he was going to be facing a re-election campaign in a couple of years. And they tried two or three things out of him. When he said communist, one of them said communism. He said, that's a good idea. Well, we can really go to town on that. And he accepted some speaking engagements on the Republican Lincoln Day speeches in February of 1953 of them. And he got his facts initially from the Chicago Tribune reporter, who gave him a lead to some files in the House Appropriations Committee. And he also called Congressman Richard Nixon's office and got some leads from him, from his people, as to where to find other things that Nixon had himself used. And then McCarthy's first speech, the one that gave him national recognition in Wheeling, West Virginia, was almost a word-for-word theft from a speech that Nixon had made on the floor of the House 2 weeks earlier. So as far as McCarthy having any convictions, no. He was hunting for an issue that had given publicity. He was strictly an opportunist.
When you became counselor for the Army in 1953, you were already aware of the techniques that he was using. You were a moderate Republican at the time. What did you think of McCarthy and his techniques?
Well, I'd been working in the government ever since World War II. I'd worked up in the Senate. I had known McCarthy before I went to work up in the Senate. I had been working for the Republican National Committee, and I'd met with McCarthy out in Wisconsin when he was campaigning. And I saw him around the Senate office building during my employment at the Senate. He always had a big grin and a big hello. He began to get all this hostile criticism after he made these attacks on the Truman administration on communism. And by then, I was working in the Defense Department, and that's a pretty busy place, and I was pretty busy, and he was attacking other people. But in the first year I was there, he attacked Anna Rosenberg, who had been nominated to be an Assistant Secretary of Defense. And, of course, the attack had been made on her on the grounds that she was communist, and nobody knew what the source of the attack was. Nobody knew the genesis of this. But the Senate Armed Services Committee, which conducted the investigation, was able to ascertain that Mrs. Rosenberg, the attack on her had been orchestrated entirely out of McCarthy's office. And I had been assigned by the Secretary of Defense to assist her in her appearances before the Senate Armed Services Committee, so I saw this thing firsthand. I was in their executive sessions with her at the time that they cleared her. And when she had a confrontation with the man who had been dug up by McCarthy and who made the accusations against her, and it became clear that all of this stuff had been orchestrated out of McCarthy's office and Congressman John Rankin, who was a member of the House on American Activities Committee. And they were after her. They were accusing her of being a Zionist Jew and that she was going to become a director of the Pentagon. And this was the first thing I saw. And then very shortly after that, General Marshall was Secretary of Defense. While I wasn't one of his close advisors, I did see him occasionally, and he was a great man. McCarthy attacked General Marshall in one of the most famous attacks that he made during his entire time, in which he accused McCarthy and Secretary of State Atchison in being a part of a conspiracy so immense as to something like dwarf the imagination of all men of honor or something like that. And I'd seen these two things, and then his attacks were primarily towards the State Department and people who had worked in the State Department and former State Department officials. And they were very brutal, and I think it's pretty easy when you're not yourself a part of it, you see it going on someplace else, just to think that it's going to go away. But it doesn't go away. What he said about Marshall was that He and Matheson were part of a conspiracy so immense as to dwarf any such previous venture in history, an infamy so black as to ever deserve the malediction of all honest men. Now, that's a pretty terrible thing to say about somebody like General Marshall, who was considered by most people in the Western world who have really been the architect of the victory against Hitler, and who was Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. President Truman called General Marshall the greatest living American. And so I was seeing these things happening primarily, once in a while, to the Defense Department, but primarily to people who were kind of misty figures as far as I was concerned, because I wasn't in contact with them. And I just had a feeling that I think a lot of people had, that somebody who was as extreme as McCarthy just couldn't last. But of course, this is a foolish thing to do, you see. Nobody should do that, because there are always these unexpected gusts of mass hysteria that underneath the veneer of civilized people, there's a capacity for hysteria, and somebody like McCarthy can orchestrate it and light a fuse to it. And you can't ignore that sort of thing. And there were too many people. I was a very obscure, minor, middle-level government official at this time. But the Senate, particularly, was really... it failed in its duty to stand up to McCarthy and to stop his misbehavior. The Senate was wrong. The Republican leadership was wrong. The Eisenhower administration was wrong to let him go like he did.
John Adams is my guest, if you're just joining us, and he's written a new book called Without Precedent, and it's about the period that he spent as counsel to the Army, and this was the period right before and during the Army-McCarthy hearings. Well, your first mission when you joined the Army's legal counsel was to be the liaison with McCarthy. Now, what did the Army think that that meant, and what did McCarthy think that that meant?
Well, McCarthy, prior to the time that I had taken this position, McCarthy had begun investigating, in the McCarthy technique of investigation, what he contended were was a communist cell existing at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. Fort Monmouth was the Army Signal Corps installation where all of the radar techniques were developed and contracts for scientific electronic stuff was handled. And there was a large number of people there. It had a great population, I think something like 17,000 people and about 5,000 civilian employees, large numbers of engineers and scientists. And, of course, Fort Monmouth within 30 miles of New York and would became a great employment haven for people who graduated from places like CCNY and New York University and these people who had grown up in New York City. And the consequence was that the great, great numbers of them, the engineers and the scientists, were New York Jews, New York Jewish men of Russian descent. And they were prime targets for somebody like McCarthy, because Julius Rosenberg, the atomic spy who'd been executed in 1950, had gone to CCNY, and he was the same age as many of these men, in their mid or upper 30s, 30, 35, 36, 37. He'd gone to school with many of them, and many of them knew him. And so when I was assigned to the liaison with this committee, I found McCarthy up to his neck, not up to his neck, up to the limit of his mischief in accusing these people. And he was doing it because somebody had taken an old letter which the FBI had sent to the Army, dated in December of 1950, which had 35 names on it, almost all of them New York, people from New York, the New York colleges, Russian Jewish descent, employed at Fort Monmouth. And this letter was headed Aaron H. Coleman, Espionage R. The R stood for Russian. Aaron Coleman was the first name on the list. That's, it was alphabetical, and that's the reason they headed it this way. And the letter was 16 pages long, single-spaced. And the Army had these 35 names on it with investigative reports on each of these people. And the Army had, during the period of the 3 years subsequent to receipt of this letter, had investigated every one of these people, had them sometimes twice and sometimes three times before loyalty boards, and every one of these people had been cleared for continuing employment. And McCarthy got this letter through the help of one of these people that he called his loyal American underground. He got a precis of this letter, which had been reduced to 2.5 pages. This letter later became known in the Army McCarthy hearings as the purloined letter. And he had this information, these names, but the Army didn't know that he had this letter and these names. But we know that he was tearing Fort Monmouth and the morale at Fort Monmouth apart. So that was what I was assigned to, not to find out what was going on, but to see what he had on these people. The Secretary of the Army's policy had been one of cooperation with McCarthy. And so McCarthy was very generously letting the Army representative, which was me, into his executive sessions. And so I was seeing, and I was the only person in the government who was seeing, what McCarthy was doing and what he was getting from these people, which was practically nothing, and then seeing him go out from this executive session and tell the press an entirely different thing. And I saw this going on constantly. He would have an executive session where some person would say practically nothing, and because there was nothing to say, was some person whose name might be on this or a neighbor of some person whose name might have been on this purloined letter. And after he would interrogate them, he'd go out and he'd tell the press something entirely different. And, of course, the press was helpless. All they could do would be write what he told them, a Senate committee chairman. And, of course, he was a committee of one. He had the Democrats on the committee had become so outraged at his behavior that they had all quit, which made him a committee of four, three Republicans and himself. And the other three Republicans never attended committee hearings. So it was a committee of one. And most committees have a subpoena power. The subpoena power is supposed to be granted by a vote of the full committee, but he never took a vote. He just signed blank committees and put them in the pockets of all his investigators, and anybody they met that they didn't like, they'd throw a subpoena at him. Then these people would have to come in to one of these hearings and get abused by McCarthy. Then he'd go out and say something absolutely contrary to what he'd heard.
You said that the press was helpless here. Did you feel helpless as well?
Well, you are pretty helpless in those circumstances. One of the things that I felt helpless about is we didn't really know what McCarthy had initially. You see, we didn't know what his sources were. We didn't know that he had this purloined letter until many months later. We didn't know where he was getting this information. And the press found itself helpless because they weren't getting into the executive sessions. They weren't reporting what they were seeing. They were only reporting what they were told. And it was a question, if I don't put this in my paper and the other fellow does, he gets a scoop on me. And so they would put a McCarthy lie in the paper and it would be spread all over the country. If a correction came out by the person who had been accused later, the correction would be on page 7, a two or three-inch column. And McCarthy had a great skill at this manipulating the press, which he did constantly. And the press knew it was being manipulated, and but they felt helpless about it. And this was the way he built his great brush fire of excitement about what he was doing. Press was afraid not to print what he was announcing.
Did the Army want you to cooperate fully with McCarthy?
Yes, the policy of the Secretary of the Army had been to cooperate with McCarthy to help him, in the hope that McCarthy would finally find that there was nothing at Fort Monmouth and it would dry up. In fact, that almost happened. McCarthy, after about 6 weeks, said there wasn't anything at the Fort Monmouth investigation. He was going to go on to other things. And the Secretary of Stevens' people were insisting, his public relations people were insisting that he had to have a press release, press conference, and he did have a press conference about the middle of November, 6 or 8 weeks after I was on the job, in which he stated, Secretary Stevens asked me first, he said, I'm going to have this press conference. What'll I talk about? We just had a big budget cut. He wanted to talk about the strength of the Army, and I said, they're not going to ask you about that. They're going to ask you about Fort Monmouth, and they're going to ask you what spies are at Fort Monmouth. And he said, well, there aren't any, are there? I said, no, there are none that we can find. Of course, Rosenberg worked there 8 or 9 years ago, so you've got to assume that back at that time there might have been some, but we don't know any, and McCarthy hasn't found any. Of course, if he does find one, and you say that there are no spies, then we're dead. But so far as I know, there are none. So Secretary Steuben said, well, I think I've just got the chance that I'm going to say there are no spies at Monmouth. Well, when he did that, McCarthy was in Albany, New York, on one of his phony investigations of a defense plant, and New York Times headline said, Stevens says no spies at Monmouth. Well, this enraged McCarthy, just enraged him. So he started the investigation all over again, you see. And Stevens decided we better try to make peace again, and we went to New York to try to mollify him again. And we had a luncheon meeting with him in one of the downtown clubs that Mr. Secretary Stevens was a member of. And Stevens said, well, I didn't say anything except that the Army didn't know about any spies. We didn't say what McCarthy knew. And McCarthy said, well, you just called me a liar for the whole world to see. Well, of course, that was pretty true, but it was better not to say that, I guess. So Secretary Stevens said, well, I'll tell the press that insofar as I know, there are none, but you may have some different information. Some of the newsmen, particularly the hostile right-wing press, told me that Secretary Stevens had eaten crow by doing that. Of course, he had eaten. He had backed down a little bit, but he hadn't backed off his statement that there were no spies that he knew of. But McCarthy kept going, and the thing about it was that the Fort Monmouth investigation was kind of drying up, but he had another thing that he was attacking, and he'd been constantly attacking. It had been being attacked by the right wing of the Republican Party since well before the 1952 election, and that was what they called loyalty boards. Now, loyalty boards were a creature of the Truman administration, which Mr. Truman had created, I think, because of the right-wing attacks that there were too many alleged communists in the government. And if a person was accused of something, a board of civil servants in the State Department, Foreign Service officers in the Defense Department, it'd be military department people, would be designated by the secretary, and they would hear the charges, and this person would be before them. But the criterion of the Truman Loyalty Board was very tough. The board needed only to have reasonable doubts as to a person's disloyalty, and he'd be fired. Now, in a criminal case, if a person is charged, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty. And that was a very tough situation, and many present-day writers say that the red hunting started with that program. But when the Eisenhower administration came in, the drumbeat criticism about communists in the State Department and the communists who had caused us to lose our control over our influence over China in 1950 was all part of the old Roosevelt-Truman administration. So the Eisenhower administration, it was really the Justice Department, Attorney General Brownell, modified, or I should say strengthened, or made more tough the loyalty board rules over those of the Truman administration. And in the Eisenhower administration, a person who was accused had to prove his loyalty. Now, he had to prove it in a dark room where he couldn't see any accuser. I mean, at that time, using that figuratively. He never saw a person who accused him. He wasn't told the name of a person who'd made any charge against him. He never saw any paper. And this loyalty board would sit there, and they would look at documents that he wasn't able to see. And these people were all being just fired in the dark under the Eisenhower Loyalty Board program. Well, in the late days of the Truman administration, the early days of the Eisenhower administration, loyalty boards were clearing a number of people in the Army who had been accused. And to McCarthy, that meant that the loyalty boards themselves were communists. And he could find out the names of these board members, and he began to subpoena them. Well, I told McCarthy and I told Roy Cohn, who was his chief counsel, that they weren't going to appear, that their situation was exactly the same as a judge. You don't pull the Supreme Court into a legislative committee and ask them why they made a decision that way. You don't pull a judge in before a legislative committee of Pennsylvania to ask him why he made this decision in Philadelphia. You know, any adjudicatory board has the same necessity for immunity from subsequent criticism. Otherwise, there's no chance that the judges or the board will have any objectivity. So when McCarthy began to try to subpoena these loyalty boards, it became very, very serious. And I got the agreement of the Secretary of the Army and the Defense Department and the Justice Department that we were not going to permit these loyalty boards to be subpoenaed or any of the members. Now, at the same time, McCarthy had one of his former staff members, David Shine, who had been drafted, and they were putting tremendous pressure on us to give this fellow special favors, to give him an assignment in New York where he was supposed to read West Point textbooks, if McCarthy had his way, to decide whether they were communist-inspired and things like that. It was really comic. And when, in January of 1954, when Roy Cohn found out that Dave Shine was going to have to serve 7 months at Camp Gordon, Georgia, instead of getting a New York assignment, he rushed up to Washington from Miami, where he got this information, and the next morning they issued some subpoenas for some loyalty board members, and I wasn't able to stop it, so I went up, instead of sending these board members, I went up myself, and I told McCarthy they weren't going to come, and that I would appear, but they wouldn't come. And and when I got this subpoena, before I went up to see McCarthy, I had called the Attorney General. I demanded an appointment, and I said, "Now, the Army can't do this alone. Either the administration's got to stand up to McCarthy on this issue," which they had told us earlier they would do, "and if they will not stand up to the issue, to this, the great big press coverage on this, then the press and the world is going to say that the Eisenhower administration is finally backed down to McCarthy." So the Attorney General told me that they would back me on this position. And McCarthy, when I went before him that day and told him our people were not going to come up there, he closed the hearing and said he'd give them until next week and to appear. And then he asked me to come to his – I went back to my office. And he called, his office called, and asked me to come to his house that night, his apartment. I went to his home that night, and he tried to talk me into some deal where these people could come up so he could save face. He said, "I won't ask them anything about communism, but I just want the press to see them coming into my executive session. You can come with them." I said, "I'm not even going to do that. They're not going to come." And this was the sort of thing that was going on. And this and a couple of other incidents at the same time were really what caused the Army McCarthy hearings. My unwillingness to let the loyalty board appear and the Army's unwillingness to give special favors to their former staff member, Shine, plus a third thing, which was the incident involving a dentist by the name of Perez. Dr. Perez had been drafted. He had about 12 years of private practice. He'd been drafted as a dentist and given a commission as a captain, and then a law had been passed. They'd drafted about 700 doctors and dentists, and the law was passed to give them constructive service, so they got a rank commensurate with their private practice. And Dr. Perez was promoted to major, along with about 159 other dentists who were promoted. When Perez had entered the military service, at that time everybody had to fill in what they call loyalty security papers, about 7 pages long, and he hadn't filled in the questions about do you belong to any subversive organization. He'd just written the words "federal constitutional privilege" across it. Well, those documents went through a different channel than his induction papers, and he was already in the service as a captain. He'd been serving for some months, doing nothing but being trained in military dental techniques. When the information that he had not answered these questions, he in effect had taken the Fifth Amendment, reached the Army High Command, and a decision was made to separate him from the service. Well, about this time, again, after the decision had been made to separate him from the service, he was told that he could have up to 90 days to get out. He selected 90 days hence so that he'd have lead time. He was on duty at Camp Kilmer, which is very near New York City. His wife and child were in New York City. And after this all occurred, McCarthy's staff found out that this person, a doctor, a dentist, a doctor, a major, or a captain, was on duty at Camp Kilmer. Roy Cohn, McCarthy's counsel, called me and said, "You've got a doctor, a dentist, who's a captain or a major, and he's a communist. He's on duty at Camp Kilmer." Well, I went to the Army Chief of Intelligence, and he came back into my office in about 2 hours and said, "We know about this fellow. We're putting him out of the Army." Well, I thought that meant today. That was a great mistake on my part, because if I'd known that it meant 3 months from now, I'm sure I would have gone to the Secretary of the Army, the Undersecretary of the Army, or the Army Chief of Staff, and said, "Get this fellow out today." I didn't do that, and a couple of weeks elapsed, and he was still in the Army. I thought he was gone, and they found his name. They sent somebody over to Camp Kilmer, one of the investigators, and they talked to somebody there who gave him the name. So then they issued a subpoena for him to appear before McCarthy's committee. And here this meant that McCarthy was going to have a fellow before one of his open sessions in New York City wearing the uniform of the United States Army as an officer who probably would take the Fifth Amendment. I shook the trees as hard as I could trying to see if I couldn't get him out of the Army, but I couldn't do it because the Army personnel staff said he's got the same right everybody else has.
Why did you want to get him out?
Well, I felt that it would be damaging to the Army for an Army officer to appear before McCarthy and take the Fifth Amendment. That it would be better, as long as he was getting out anyway, why not appear before McCarthy as a civilian? He was going to be a civilian in 60 days anyway. So I just felt that as a matter of appearances for the Army, it would be better that he be a former Army officer. But I didn't succeed there, and he appeared, and as soon as he had a good laundering by McCarthy, he came back to the Army, said, I want out tomorrow. I don't want to wait the 60 or 75, 65 days I have left. I want out tomorrow. So this request was granted. When it was granted, McCarthy heard about it, and he sent a letter over to the Pentagon. Hold this fellow in the Army for court-martialing. Secretary of the Army was in Japan. So the letter came to me. The decision had to be made. Are we going to keep him for court-martialing or let him out? He goes out tomorrow. So I talked to some people in the chief of personnel's office, and I decided, nobody else, that we weren't going to hold him. We let him get out of the Army the next day as he asked. McCarthy wanted him held for court-martial. Well, there was no grounds to court-martial. Everybody, the judge advocate general, the chief personnel, said there are no grounds to court-martial. We'd already lost a case that had gone to the highest military tribunal on the very same charges within a year. So we let him get out. So I let him get out. And this caused McCarthy to go around the country, made speeches and accusing the Army of having sheltered a communist spy, having stopped his transfer to the Orient. We had brought him back from Seattle to Camp Kilmer because his wife and child were sick, and he'd asked the Red Cross to intervene on his behalf, and they had investigated and found that his wife and child were sick. So he was brought back from Seattle, and he was serving at Camp Kilmer. McCarthy said that there was a communist conspiracy to promote him, that it was a communist conspiracy to cancel his overseas order and bring him back to New York, and that it was a communist conspiracy to let him out of the Army. So he had this, and he began saying, who promoted Perez? And this was number three. The other was the Cheyenne matter, and the other was the loyalty boards. And these things precipitated the Army McCarthy hearings.
So what was the goal of the hearings?
Well, that's been a mystery to me for 29 years. It didn't seem to have any goal. I felt that the thing was very badly handled. The tragedy of the Army McCarthy hearings was that it was a committee investigating itself. McCarthy was the chairman of this committee, and he stepped aside, ostensibly, and let Carl Mundt, a Republican from South Dakota, who was the next ranking Republican, become chairman. McCarthy sat at the end of the table, but he was pulling the strings. He was orchestrating it. The Republicans had the majority, and they did what McCarthy wanted them to do, and their only objective was to save McCarthy and to save McCarthyism. And the hearings, insofar as proving anything of substance, accomplished nothing, but they did accomplish one thing. They kept McCarthy on the witness stand for 36 days. They kept him before television for 36 days. You see, television was in his infancy then. McCarthy had never really been televised before. And he was personally a kind of a genial, jovial, amiable fellow, but he really had kind of an ugly personality. He was brutal, and he was ignorant, and he was a bully. And in the 36 days that the television was shining that little red bead on him, and he was behaving the way he had behaved for 4 years, the American people began to see what a few newspaper men were saying, but not all. And the American people themselves began to take the measure of the man. And it really was television, the Army McCarthy hearings and television, that destroyed McCarthy and ended McCarthyism.
You had complained before that the press was only able to get what McCarthy told them, and that there was no other side that was readily available to them. You had leaked right at the beginning of the Army McCarthy hearings some documents that you had, which chronicled your meetings with McCarthy and some of his methods of harassment. How was that covered by the press, and were you satisfied with that?
Well, what had happened was that when McCarthy, in the incident I told you about on the day that I went to his home, that afternoon I had gone to the Attorney General's office and said the administration's got to stand up now. If they back down, why, the world will know, the press will know that Eisenhower is back down to McCarthy. Present at that meeting was Sherman Adams, former governor of New Hampshire and the chief of staff to the president, the senior person in the government next to the president. And Governor Adams asked me if I had a record of all these incidents I was telling him about, and I said that I did not. He suggested that I ought to make one. So in the next week or so, I put together all the memoranda I had, memoranda of records, memoranda of phone call, and I filled in the areas where I didn't have it with narratives of what had occurred. And this made about a 40-page document, which was a diary. And it was just a diary of what had happened from the day that I first met McCarthy in October up until January, about 4 months. And I had this document in my desk, and I'd showed it to various people in the Pentagon, and I'd showed it to a couple of senators. And it was known, and copies of it were in the hands of the White House and in the hands of the Justice Department. And Joe Alsup, who was a well-known political columnist of the day, came into my office one day. I didn't know him at all. And he said he'd come from the White House, and that Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the U.N. delegate to a former United States senator and who had a White House office and helped them periodically in congressional matters, and who also had been at that meeting at the Justice Department with Governor Adams. Henry Cabot Lodge said, if you want to know about McCarthy and what he's doing, go over to see Adams at the Pentagon. I didn't consider this an order that I was to show Joe Alsup my paper, but my paper had no classification. It was just my own diary, so I showed it to Joe Alsup. Well, he came in and asked me what I knew about McCarthy, and I started to tell him, but I realized it was going to take me about 3 hours to do it. But if he read this document in about 20 minutes, it saved me all that time. So I showed him the document. And then as soon as I did it, I realized, well, I can't just show it to one columnist. I said, I'll show you this, but I don't want you to say that you've seen it here. So I called up three other newspaper men I know, and I invited them to come over, and I showed it to them too. Well, this is really spilling the beans, because you show it to them and say you can't really use this. And when I did that, of course, they just were obsessed that they were going to get that document busted loose, because it was the most damning indictment of McCarthy that you can imagine. McCarthy and McCarthyism. And, of course, this was a bomb that was just waiting to explode. And people in the Defense Department got uneasy, because one of the newsmen went up to the Secretary of Defense and said, I've seen a document, and there's lots of them around. Well, there weren't lots of them around. There's just one in my office.
What was some of the most damaging information in there?
Well, the narrative, the documentation of the telephone calls and the abusive telephone calls that we had had and the threats that had been made to us. We're going to wreck the Army. And one time they said if we did anything that they didn't like about Private Shine. And another time when I said that something, I told one of them that the fellow was due for over, what's going to happen if he gets overseas duty, which anybody could expect if he was a draftee. And Roy Cohn said to me, Stevens is through as Secretary of the Army. I mean, that sort of thing was being told us. And this was all documented, and this was a damning indictment of McCarthy and McCarthyism and of his staff. And if it got out, why, it was going to explode. Well, it did get out. And it was edited somewhat, prepared by the Defense Department into what they called a chronology of events, which was submitted to McCarthy's committee, just his committee, including McCarthy. Well, of course, the Senate and the House both leak like sieves, and as soon as one senator gets something, why, every newsman he's trying to make medicine with knows about it. And, of course, we were just overrun by people who wanted copies of it, and in no time at all, it was out.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just tuning in. I'm speaking with John G. Adams, and he was counsel to the Army during the time of the Army-McCarthy hearings and directly preceding those hearings. And he's written a new book about the hearings and about his encounters with McCarthy. This book is called Without Precedent. You were on the stand during the Army-McCarthy hearings.
Yeah.
Can you give us some examples of the questions that were asked you that you thought were kind of typical of the kind of questioning?
Well, I don't remember many. There were so many. They were all... They didn't just ask you a question. They used their questions as means of putting in unsworn testimony. One question I recall particularly, this wasn't asked to me, it was asked to Secretary Stevens by Roy Cohn. He said, Did Mr. Adams ever tell you that the day we asked, that just before we issued this, the Army issued this report, we had requested 6 communists who work in the Army appear before our committee? Well, they made no such request at all. There were no 6 communists in the Army, but they constantly said things like that, which was unsworn, and they were constantly being objected to by Democratic members of the committee that you're using your questions as a means of getting in unsworn testimony and letting 20 million people think this is the truth. This went on constantly.
There's something that Roy Cohn had pulled on you that I think you give as an example of typical behavior on Cohn's part. He had bought you some theater tickets and managed to turn that as evidence against you in the hearings. Can you describe that incident?
Well, Cohn operated out of New York. McCarthy was in New York most of the time. He was staying in the New York hotel with his wife, guest of the United States Senate. And this caused me to go to New York very regularly during that fall and winter to go into these executive sessions. And one day when I went to New York, Roy Cohn and Frank Carr, another staff member, and I went to the fight. Cohn got the tickets. They were at Madison Square Garden. It was a championship fight, middleweight championship. Forgotten who the fighters were. One of them was an Englishman named Randy Turpin. I think the American was Bobo Wilson. And tickets cost $20. Well, that was a lot of money in 1953. It'd be about a $100 ticket now, or maybe a $200 ticket. And we got into the Garden. I tried to pay Cohn. I had cash. And he said, well, I got those tickets free. Well, it was a mistake on my part. I should have pushed the money in his pocket, but I didn't. And a couple of weeks later, I was in New York, and I said, I want to go to the theater tonight. I don't know where I can get tickets. And he says, well, I'll call and get them for you. Or maybe I said to him, will you call? I don't know. It doesn't make much difference. But anyway, he called, and he said the tickets will be at the box office. I got there. The tickets were at the box office. I was taking 2 of my aunts who lived in Brooklyn, and the tickets were paid for. Cohn had paid for them. Well, this was not something I had wanted. And the next morning when I checked out of my hotel, the room was paid for, charged to Cohn. Well, I paid for it and got a receipt. And then I was angry about that, and but I didn't see Cohn for quite a few weeks. He stayed in New York, and I was back in Washington. Next time I saw him, I shoved this money in his pocket, and I told him I was offended that for both the fight ticket and for the theater tickets, and told him I didn't want to be obligated to him. He was very offended, very offended. And he said, well, I don't play that way. But when the Army McCarthy hearings came along, why, he turned it around. And in one of his questions, he said, when we were abusing you, or when we were doing this, did I arrange a theater party for you? And did I take you to the fights or something like that? Well, this was very embarrassing, but what did I do about it? But it was typical of what went on. They were more interested in embarrassing their adversaries than in developing any facts.
Is there an incident from the Army McCarthy hearings that really stands out in your mind as being the most damaging to McCarthy?
Oh, the thing that was the highlight of the hearing, of course, was when McCarthy attacked one of Welch, who was the Army's counsel, who had been brought down to represent the Army because I couldn't represent the Army because I was myself one of the accused. Welch was baiting McCarthy constantly, and he was an artist at this. And he offended McCarthy, and McCarthy was scared of him. He was the only person in the whole hearing that McCarthy called by his last name, Mr. Welch. He tried to call Secretary of the Army Stevens. He called the other senators by their first name, but he kept his distance from Welch. And McCarthy, Welch, there was a young man who had come down with Welch the first day, and Welch sent him back because the young man said, I belong to a league when I was in Harvard Law School, which was later put on the American, the Attorney General's list as being subversive. And so Welch sent him back to Boston. But McCarthy found this out. He seemed to be able to find out everything. And McCarthy waited until one day he was particularly he was enraged at Welch's cross-examination of Cohn. Welch was really embarrassing Cohn. And McCarthy blew a stack, and he attacked Welch, and then he attacked this young man who he said in his law firm who was a communist or something like that, and McCarthy and Welch was very indignant, and he tore into McCarthy and made this famous remark, "Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you no sense of decency?" Well, this was really the highlight of the hearings, and there was a great audience of those hearings, a couple of hundred people, and they both burst into wild applause when he said this. McCarthy didn't even know what he'd done. He said to some people, turned to him open, spread his hands, "What did I do? What did I do?" He was so brutal and so insensitive, he didn't have any compassion. He didn't care what he did to anybody or who he hurt. Didn't care what the consequences of it were, so that he didn't really understand how he had misbehaved, and he didn't really understand, although Roy Cohn did and some of McCarthy's friends, that McCarthy was ruining himself. He was constantly shooting himself in the foot, and this time he shot himself in the foot, both feet at the same time. This, I think, was probably the highlight of the hearings.
What was the committee's verdict?
Well, it was very indecisive. I've forgotten. There was a number of, they accused McCarthy and his staff of being improper in their request of the Army, and he accused he criticized Secretary Stevens for appeasing McCarthy, and they said that it was indefensible that I had revealed this information about McCarthy's behavior to the press. I never was able to make them understand that this was public business, that it was just a story of one taxpayer-supported body's misbehavior in its relationship with another taxpayer-supported body. But at that time, the Senate and the House both felt that most of what they did should be secret. Nobody had a right to know if they were misbehaving. And the verdict really didn't say much. It was the people's verdict that counted, and the people no longer were interested in McCarthy after the McCarthy hearings. And the Army-McCarthy hearings finished McCarthy.
If you could do it over again, would you change any of the actions you made or the decisions that you made?
Oh, I guess everybody could second-guess what they've done, but I think you've got to be satisfied with the end result, which was the destruction of McCarthyism. I think that was worthwhile. But I think there is something that you've got to remember. You can always be another McCarthy. It wouldn't exactly be a carbon copy of Joe McCarthy of 1954 because of his vulgarity and his rudeness and his patent brutality. That sort of man couldn't last today because of television, but if you had a man who had the style and the real TV charisma, somebody like Robert Redford or Paul Newman, but if you gave him the ugly soul and the evil motives of McCarthy and coupled it with McCarthy's talents and skill for manipulating the press, you could mean trouble.
John Adams is my guest, and he was counsel to the Army right before and during the period of the Army-McCarthy hearings, which led to McCarthy's downfall. You tell a story in your book that I just found pretty amazing. He called you after the hearings were over and invited you to his house for dinner, asked you to bring your wife. And your wife, really hating McCarthy and everything he stood for, had no intention of going, so you basically turned down that part of the invitation. And he said, "You know these girls, they take it seriously."
Well, that incident occurred a couple of months after the Army McCarthy, or long after the McCarthy hearings, after McCarthy had been censured. And it was a Saturday afternoon, and my wife answered the phone. "Mrs. Adams, this is Joe McCarthy." Of course, she was absolutely astounded. She'd never met him, never talked to him. She despised him. She came in, and I was taking a nap on the sofa. And I answered the phone. She said, "It's Joe McCarthy for you." He asked me to come to dinner next Monday night. He said that Senator Symington and his wife would be there, and Roy Cohn was coming down from New York. Well, I knew darn well Stu Symington wasn't going to be in McCarthy's home, and I didn't want to be there. Under any circumstance, I said, "Joe, I can't come to your home. I can't ask my wife to come to your home. She despises you. She wouldn't set foot in your threshold." And I meant it. Margaret meant it. If I had accepted that, there would have been a little assassination in my apartment that day, and I would have been the victim. But a couple of weeks later, in my office, I got another call from McCarthy. He asked me, his wife, in the meantime, I was in the gas station. She drove up at the next pump, and she said to me, "Oh, why don't you come? Joe really wants to see you. He really wants to see you, just kind of wants to make up." Well, I don't know how you can make up for the things that he had done, which we haven't discussed yet here today, but McCarthy had accused, in the Army McCarthy hearings, he had accused Secretary Stevens of some very, very disgraceful things. And he said that Stevens had offered him dirt on the Air Force and the Navy if they'd lay off the Army. Well, that was a disgraceful thing if he had done it, but he hadn't done it. And he said that when Stevens made that offer, I said, well, good, I know just the dirt I'll give to you. Well, I'd never seen that. It was an outrage. Then he also said in the Army-McCarthy hearings that he said this under oath, that I had come to his apartment that night when I went there and I'd blackmailed him. And this was headlines in every country, in every newspaper in the world. I got a letter from a woman in Paris that I'd known in World War II that I'd blackmailed McCarthy. And this was pretty hard to take, to have these accusations made in the world press and not... You see, the Senate did never address itself to these charges, to these allegations by McCarthy. They were never disposed of. So I went around, and Secretary Stevens went around subsequently with many people thinking that we had done these things. And this was a very, very unfortunate thing for a senator or Senate committee to do. But all of this was in the spectrum of my remembrance when McCarthy called me again at my office after I'd seen his wife at this gas station. He asked me to come to see him, and he'd already been censured, and by then he was drinking a lot, and he was not going over to the Senate office building, although his apartment house was only three blocks away. So I went over to his house, and he was alone there. I mean, his wife was there, and she walked out to my left there with her mother and left. And I sat in the living room, and he wanted to find out some way. Wasn't there some way that we could get together and issue a statement that would rehabilitate him? And I said, it's no good, Joe. It won't work. I said, you can't change the truth. And the truth was he was ruined. There was nothing else important. And he just wanted me, he thought, if I could change what I had and repudiate the Army position, it would somehow make McCarthy a whole man again. Well, you can't do that.
You mentioned several times that people were afraid to stand up to him or had to decide whether they would take a stand and stand up to him. Why do you think it took so long for people to be able to do that?
Well, I don't think they'd ever done it except for the Army-McCarthy incident. The Eisenhower administration wasn't doing it, and they even some writers now that say McCarthy was being secretly surrounded by Eisenhower programs. That just wasn't so. The Eisenhower administration was dragged kicking and screaming into their confrontation with McCarthy as a result of the position that the Army took and insisted that they take also. Without that, I don't know how long it would go on, would have gone on. You see, McCarthy was a very formidable fellow. You know, the Senate was scared to death of him. Individually, a few senators stood up to him, but most of them were scared to death of him. It's hard to understand now what he was like, how brutal he was, and how terribly he could tear people apart. Walter Lippmann, who was the greatest political commentator of the era, wrote of him that this is the totalitarianism of the man, his cold, calculating, sustained, ruthless effort to make himself feared. He's been staging a series of demonstrations, each designed to show that he respects nobody, no office, no institution in the land. Richard Rovere, who was a well-known political writer of the day, he wrote in his book, he was a stinker. He never was sincere. Christ, what a laugh. He never thought of believing in what he was doing. I mean, a person like that, it's a terrible thing.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but what happened to your career after the Army-McCarthy hearings?
My career ended. I mean, I left the government then by invitation. My job was really a job of liaison with Congress. And no congressman wanted to talk to me then. They just wanted to stay as far away from me as they could. The Army-McCarthy hearings showed that Secretary Stevens had all of his telephone calls recorded coming in. This scared the congressman to death. And in the last month, by direction from above, my calls had been monitored also. And nobody wanted to deal with me, and I was kind of a pariah. I was a leper, and my usefulness in that job was through, and I left the Pentagon. And I didn't want to leave my friends and my career, but I couldn't stay. There was just nothing I could do about it. I left the Pentagon, went into private practice law, where I stayed for quite some time.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the period that you spent as counsel to the Army, the period during the Army-McCarthy hearings. Did you want to add something?
How much time do we have left?
We have about a minute if you wanted to add something.
Well, I'd say you've got to remember that there's always a danger that somebody like McCarthy can emerge again. You shouldn't forget the remembrance of Hitler. That was 50 years ago. Hitler achieved his control by constitutional means, and he was very much like McCarthy. But when he became president, not till he became president, did he crack down on the press. When he cracked down on the press, it was all over in Germany. McCarthy was after the press all the time, and he was playing around with the presidential nomination in 52. Things have to fall in place. They didn't fall in place for McCarthy. But if they had fallen in place for him like they had it with Hitler, Lord knows what this country would have seen.
Well, thanks. Thanks for those words, and thanks for talking with us. John G. Adams has been my guest, and he was counsel to the Army. The period just before the Army-McCarthy hearings, it was in part his actions that precipitated the Army-McCarthy hearings, which in turn led to the downfall of McCarthy. Adams chronicles this whole period in his new book, which is called Without Precedent, and Without Precedent has just been published by Norton Books. It's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air in just a minute, but let's check in first with shadow traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Some heavy volume on both sides of the Schuylkill Expressway, eastbound from Spring Garden through South, westbound from Bear through Vine, and then from the Twin Bridges to west of City Line Avenue. The Wissahickon Drive off-ramp also running slow. Northbound Wissahickon Drive is slow from approaching Henry through Rittenhouse. I-95, the normal mile backup approaching the Ray Street merger if you're traveling southbound, about a 5 to 10 minute delay off the Girard Point Bridge down to the Platte Detour Road at Island. The Tacony-Palmyra Bridge is scheduled for a 6 o'clock opening. It's a double opening, so it'll be a long one. The Betsy Ross Bridge will be your alternate for that, and no major problems heading into New Jersey crossing the Ben Franklin or Walt Whitman bridges. And that's shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
That shadow traffic report was funded with a grant from Wilkie Buick Subaru. I'll be taking tomorrow off. Fresh Air will be hosted by Danny Miller, and Danny will be speaking at 3 o'clock with Gerald Peel, who's the president and publisher of Scientific American. He's held that position since 1947. He'll be discussing his confrontations with the government over the publication of articles about the atomic bomb. At about 3:50, Danny will speak with Eric Weber, who is the author of the classic book How to Pick Up Girls and How to Make Love to a Single Girl, as well as 100 Best Opening Lines. And at 4:25, we'll feature a radio drama by Joe Frank, so I hope you can be listening. Sunday afternoon on the Best of Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, we'll feature interviews with Cleo Lane and John Dankworth. She's a singer, he's a composer, saxophonist, and arranger. They're married. And we'll also hear from Tony Bennett. We'll be highlighting his recent visit just a couple of weeks ago here on Fresh Air, so I hope you can be listening Sunday at 2 o'clock. Well, that about does it for this afternoon's program. Ron Carson was the technical director today. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller, the co-producer of the program. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listeners supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Noah Adams.
And I'm Susan.